Today on the Potential Psychology Podcast.
When you reshape your job, reshape it in a way where you feel you're making a meaningful contribution to others. It can be your colleague or to a societal cause, and that can be climate change. So if you, let's say that you're in charge of procurement or something at a big company, if you just decide, well, what if we decide to buy environmentally friendly products from here on out? Or what if we decide to just buy products that we know are have a zero carbon footprint? You've job crafted, but you've also job purposed. And that small change moves you. I mean, it sounds so small, but as humans, basically, purpose and meaning in terms of making contributions to others are so important to us. We're so social. We're so interconnected that we are like exquisitely sensitive to small acts of purpose.
Welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, psychologist Ellen Jackson, and this is the show in which we explore what it is to be human and how we as humans can fulfill our potential. So hello and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I am thrilled to be back in my little studio, this new little studio that I'm in today at Platypus Co-working here in Ballarat, with a new guest to the show. Her name is Bea Boccolandro. She's speaking to me from California in the United States. She is the founder and president of the global purpose advisory firm, VeroWorks. She has 2 decades of experience helping business make customers' interactions more human, products more inclusive, operations more environmentally sustainable, marketing more charitable, and otherwise just making work more meaningful. Bea has worked with a raft of big name clients, including Bank of America, Disney, Eventbrite, FedEx, HP, IBM, Levi's, PwC, Tom's Shoes and Toyota. She also has 15 years experience teaching corporate social purpose and corporate social responsibility, otherwise known as CSR, at Georgetown University, Boston College and the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Bea was born in Caracas, Venezuela, but today lives with her husband in San Clemente, California, where, and I love this, she is a proud Rotarian and comically bad surfer. Welcome, Bea. I'm thrilled to have you with us to talk a little bit about purpose and how it relates to our working life in particular.
I'm so excited to be here, Ellen, and I love the podcast that you have crafted. And I'm just suspecting that it's going to be a higher level conversation than I normally get to have. Just based
That's lovely to hear. That's lovely to hear. That is something, and I believe that's something that our listeners appreciate, is that we do get a chance to kind of go deep and sometimes get a little bit esoteric, but also try and tie that up with the practical. I know that's one of the things that I love about podcasting, is that unlike other forms of media where you have little sound grabs and clickbaity stuff or whatever it might be, this really does give us a chance to go deep into topics and to explore and to, you know, find some of the nuance, and that's all the fun stuff. So we're really excited to have you here. I haven't mentioned, but I'm remiss in not doing so, that you are also, of course, the author, and I've got my book here. So for anyone watching on video, the author of this fabulous book, Do Good at Work, How Simple Acts of Social Purpose Drive Success and Wellbeing. And that's what we're here to talk about today, this notion of purpose and how it can be interwoven into our working lives, because it's something that I'm really excited about. I'm really quite passionate about, but I think it's relatively new as a concept to a lot of people. Would that be true, Bea?
Absolutely. And I think that not only is it new, it's very poorly misunderstood. I think when people hear purpose, the first thing they think is like, yes, what is my life's purpose? And there's nothing wrong with that inquiry. It's a fantastic inquiry to go into. It's great if you can answer that question for yourself. And it's even greater if you can answer that question for yourself and then find a way to get paid for it, which is where people go, right? So what is my life's purpose? And then how do I find a way to get paid for it? That is all a very productive path, but it is a daunting one. And I don't think most people have the available time, the available resources to do justice to that. But purpose is actually anything that gives you a sense of meaning after the fact. And so people confuse these two terms. So purpose is the intent of doing something that is worthwhile. Meaning is post acting on purpose, feeling like, oh, wow, my day was meaningful because I did X. And you can bask in purpose without having a clue what your life's purpose is. You can go day to day having that uplifting sense of purpose, that which is, you know, it's warm, it's hopeful. This is all physiological, by the way. So, you know, they can tell what's going on in our brains when we benefit from purpose and not have to answer that daunting question.
And that's such a great way to delineate the two, because I know the terms meaning and purpose, you know, quite often we use those together. I know even in psychology, we'll often talk about, you know, having a sense of meaning and purpose in life, like they are one and the same. But what you're saying is that they are, that sense of meaning is a different experience. It's a emotional, psychological, probably to some extent cognitive experience, perhaps born of a bit of reflection on the doing of something. And then that sense of purpose is perhaps more of the action, the doing of it, rather than this kind of life's purpose idea.
Yes. And I wish I could claim credit for that, but that's Anthony Burroughs from Cornell University, who's the one who says that. And yes, so the purpose pulls you. The meaning is, reflection is a great term, because it's upon reflection that you realize. So they both feel great. But the meaning is the, oh, I'm worth something. I have value. And so, yeah, so they're related, but they're separate. And people conflate the two terms all the time.
Mm.
Often when people, when they find out that I wrote a book to help anybody in any job do meaningful work, make a meaningful difference through their everyday job, what people immediately go to is, oh, yeah. You know, there's, well, I don't know, at least in the U.S., there's the story of John F. Kennedy asking the janitor, have we exported this story everywhere?
Well, or, I don't know. It's interesting. And I don't know whether it's, so there's a book by Martin Seligman, who's the founder of positive psychology, so to speak. Yeah. And he talks in, and I think it's probably in Authentic Happiness, a book of his, which is probably close to 20 years old now, about this story of a janitor. And I don't know where the original attribution or source is. So probably it's one and the same. So yeah, certainly it has expanded beyond your borders.
Yeah, I think, this is a happy export. So this makes me a proud American, unlike some other things that we've done. But yeah, so the story goes, and it's apparently a true story, that John F. Kennedy is visiting, I don't know if it was Florida or Texas, but wherever the NASA is launching spaceships. And he's talking to a janitor, and they're just talking about what he's doing. And he corrects the president. He's president at the time. And he says, oh, no, sir, I'm helping to put a man on the moon. And so people, at least Americans, when they find out I wrote this book, they're like, oh, yeah, because actually there's inherent value in a lot of things we do and we don't realize it. And maybe all we're doing is doing internal auditing for some big firm, but the big firm is in healthcare, so we don't realize that we're saving people's lives. That's all true. And that's where the meaning comes in, because if you don't reflect on it, you don't realize that you made a difference out there. Reflection is just hugely important for growth and learning and all those things, as you know. But it's also a very partial view of what's possible in terms of igniting purpose in your everyday job, because I like the reflection, but what I like even more is, like, mess with your job, change it, you know, on the front end go, how can this job have more purpose so that I can sit down on Friday and say, I'm proud of my work week because I made a meaningful difference. So I like telling people, you don't have to put up with the job the way you got it. You know, you can like push the edges and turn it into something that does good.
So if I'm right, what you're saying is that, because I know there has been, certainly on social media, and there's lots of discussion, and I'm sure this is the case in the States as well as in Australia, about this idea of this concept of ikigai, which is the Japanese concept of kind of meaning and purpose. And that overlaps, going back to your earlier point about there's the graphic, which I'll put in the show notes for people, but I can't imagine there's anybody who hasn't seen it, of this almost like a circumplex with all the different pieces and being able to put that together. Yep. And say, you've got to be able to do this, that, and the other, and then find a job that will pay you to do all of that. And that does lead to a lot of introspection, and it leads to a lot of perhaps dissatisfaction, almost existential crisis for some people who don't feel like they have this, you know, found their ikigai, found their sense of purpose. But what you're saying is that there's actually, you know, opportunities to kind of reframe what you do so that you can find that sense of meaning from something that perhaps doesn't, it's not obvious. It's not like a calling. It's not like you're a heart surgeon or a priest or trying to think of the things that are usually associated with a sense.
Yeah, those are them.
Calling.
Actually, you hit the top two in the U.S., surgeon and preacher, educators. Yes, okay. Otherwise, is the top three. Yeah.
Saving so. Lives and saving souls or something. I don't know. But so, you know, that we can try to find ways to reframe, which I know in psychology we call job crafting as well, part of this cognitive reframing of crafting your thoughts about your work and where it makes a meaningful purpose, perhaps to something bigger, because we know that's what helps to contribute to well-being and a sense of satisfaction in life. But there's more to it than that. You're saying that there's this kind of, you know, actually push the boundaries, play with your job, do something, which I suppose is kind of the essence of job crafting in another way, in a really practical sense.
Yes. So in fact, one of the footnotes in my book thanks Amy Ranewski and Jane Dutton for the concept of job crafting, because I'm standing on those shoulders. And as you know, but you know, for your listeners, if they're not completely up on this, job crafting is more generally like looking at your job and what's going to make you flourish and thrive about it and what isn't, and reshaping it. And so, you know, it can be something like delegating things that don't really bring you joy. So the concept I have in the book, which I call job purposing, and that is a nod to job crafting as well, is one aspect of that, which is when you reshape your job, reshape it in a way where you feel you're making a meaningful contribution to others. It can be your colleague or to a societal cause, and that can be climate change. So if you, let's say that you're in charge of procurement or something at a big company, if you just decide, well, what if we decide to buy environmentally friendly products from here on out? Or what if we decide to just buy products that we know are have a zero carbon footprint? You've job crafted, but you've also job purposed. And that small change moves you. I mean, it sounds so small, but as humans, basically purpose and meaning in terms of making contributions to others are so important to us. We're so social. We're so interconnected that we are like exquisitely sensitive to small acts of purpose. So that small act, if you think, I'm doing something, and even though it's a little bit, to counter climate change, you will physiologically respond. Your body will give you, you know, the oxytocin, the serotonin, dopamine, you know, the happy hormones that makes sex and chocolate wonderful. Like literally, it is that powerful. And so, you know, these are very small actions that have a big impact on our psychological well-being. And I think people are skeptical about that because it seems too small. right? It seems like I'm going to have to go become a surgeon or, but, you know. But my answer to that is like, just try it. Try it. One exercise I do when I give presentations is I'll ask the audience on a scale of 1 to 10, how anxious are you right now? And they write it down. And then I say, take 5 minutes and just do something for someone else or for a societal cause. It can be go into LinkedIn and give someone a positive recommendation. It can be, you can't spend more than $5, no more than $5, no more than 5 minutes. Or it can be, you can give $5 to a cause or anything that seems like a kind act. You can just go buy a bag of chips for the person next to you if you want, if they said they were hungry, like whatever. And then I have them answer, what is your level of anxiety now? And then they're all, you know, they're sitting down. So I say, okay, if your level of anxiety went up, stand up. And usually there's one or two.
I give them just about getting the activity wrong.
Yeah.
Didn't understand the assignment.
There's usually one or two. And the room I'm thinking of is in a room in Atlanta. There were probably like 600 people in the room. So there was one in the Atlanta room. And then if it stayed the same, it's about a third of the group, or yeah, about 30% of the room. And then if it went down, it's the vast majority stand up. And the only reason I feel confident, or I felt confident in even trying this the first time and doing it, is because there's so much research that shows that as soon as we do one pro-social act, which is what we're talking about here, which is just doing something for someone else or for a societal cause, it's just there is this cascading positive things that happen physiologically and cognitively as well. So an anxiety or your level of perceived stress just goes down automatically. So it's a very powerful, like, purpose with a small p of, you know, doing something meaningful, even if it's small, can be really powerful.
Yeah, it's incredible research. And we'll have to get a whole lot of those references and put them, because I know that we have listeners who like to check out the references. And I always, you know, being a nerd, like to check out the references and what have you. I've done a little bit of reading in this area, but not nearly to the depth, obviously, that you have. So is it something to do with, and this would be my kind of, I suppose, intuitive assessment, or maybe it's intuition based on being a psychologist for a long time, that when we're focusing on those other things, whether that's the person sitting next to us or somebody in our broader connected community, or that piece about perhaps doing something for somebody we don't know but who's going to benefit from a sustainability action or something else community-wise, is it that we stop focusing on ourselves at that point? Do you think that's part of what comes into this?
My answer is not going to be terribly informed, because
okay.
I don't think we have the answer to that. Like, I think they're still trying to figure that out in terms of, like, you know, functional MRIs and what they're reading when people do pro-social things. But my guess is that, yeah, I think absolutely. I'm certainly very good at brooding.
We all have our moments.
And so I think if there's any amount of that going on and you break that pattern, I mean, because I know all the research and I know how powerful it is, I use this tactic often. So if I'm having a bad morning because, you know, not too long ago, I was on the phone with a number of executives and I was trying to help them ignite purpose across the organization, and I didn't seem to be convincing them of much. So
I was going to say, you met with cynicism and skepticism.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of worse than that. I was supposed to have 15 minutes with these senior leaders. And then even before I started, they basically said, we have way more important things to do. Mm-hmm. So down to 7 minutes. And then I started, and then one of them asked a question that had like nothing to do with what I so I'm
derailed
like,
it.
They're not even interested. Like, you know, it was like a junior person that put me on the agenda, but it was like they weren't even interested in learning. Mm. So I got off and I was thinking to myself, what am I doing? Like, this is like you know, I felt like the opposite of meaning. I felt like that was just a complete waste of time. I was emotionally very dampened. And then I thought, oh, wait, I know what I need to do. I just need to spend 5 minutes doing something for someone else or for a cause out there. And I don't remember what I did. I think I went into LinkedIn and I gave someone a positive review or something like that, a positive recommendation. But soon it was history. And so I apply this often and it works.
I think our acceptance and commitment therapy colleagues would talk about that being a kind of a tool for not getting hooked in to those thinking patterns that we can have where we start to ruminate. So they talk about holding things lightly, which I think is just such a beautiful phrase, but, you know, things that upset us or distress us, if we hold them lightly and not get hooked into them. So this is perhaps a little mechanism there somehow. And I absolutely take your point because I think there's so many fascinating things about human beings where we understand that the effect is real. We understand that there is something going on. We just don't fully understand the mechanics of how that's happening yet. So, you know, whether that's something in there about being able to unhook from some unhelpful rumination by reconnecting with this meaning piece.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do want to say that there are many ways to unhook, and there are elements of unhooking in a job purposing, but if it's part of the job or in a pro-social way, that are unique. So the act of doing something to benefit someone else or a cause out there, that act is more than just breaking away from a negative pattern. It's a very positive thing to do.
So we're removing the negative, but more than replacing it with this positive, fulfilling, energizing, I'm guessing, experience.
It is energizing. So, for example, they've done research. So this is a University of Chicago academics, very, very well-designed, rigorous study. And they had these online workers, so they were alone, so they didn't communicate with colleagues. Some of them knew that their task was helping in some way, a societal cause. In this case, it was education. And others did not know that. And the ones that knew, their productivity was over 20% higher. So they would produce 20% more completed products. They were looking at photographs and analyzing them. They would analyze 20% more photographs per hour just because they knew that them doing that was helping in some not super direct way, but helping with education out there. And they took fewer breaks. So the quality was the same. And you could choose to work how many hours you wanted. They ended up working more hours. So they ended up going home with more money because you got paid by the hour. And the employer is much happier because the work is better. And then another study done by Morton Hansen at University of California, Berkeley, he found that if our jobs don't have purpose, if we don't feel that they're making a meaningful contribution to others or to society, we perform on average in the bottom 10%. As soon as we have purpose, the average performance goes to 64. So it goes to well above average performance. So energizing is a great term to apply to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's energizing in a psychological, obviously physiological sense, but also in a behavioral sense. So, you know, just our practical actions, we are staying longer at work. We're probably going over and above, you know, when we talk about workplace engagement, people being engaged at work, it's often about that notion of going over and above what it is you need to do because you feel committed to something and not just, you know, that kind of presenteeism notion of being there but not really being there. So are we talking about in some ways a solution to some of those challenges? Because I know that there'd be challenges for workplaces and leaders.
Oh, absolutely, which is why I have my day job of helping companies ignite purpose across the enterprise. So there's tons of research showing the benefits to the employer for sure. So as a manager, like even if you only have three or four people that report to you, this is also a very valuable tool. And one point that I'll make is, again, going back to kind of the skepticism, is we haven't been brought up to believe this. So we've actually brought up to believe the opposite. Like, you have to focus on yourself to succeed. And this concept feels weird because it's like, by focusing on benefiting others, I'm going to do better. That just sounds wrong. But Adam Grant, so he's an organizational psychologist at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. And of course, he's a genius because he, he endorsed my book.
Wow, yes.
You know, he has a whole book, his first book, which the title is escaping me, but debunking that idea that it's when we focus on ourselves that we do better in our careers. And one point I wanted to make is that our skepticism runs so deep on this that he did research on individuals who were telemarketers, essentially. And he came back with the results and presented it to them and said, look, isn't this interesting that when you guys realized that your jobs had purpose, you performed like twice as good, like 181%, higher productivity. They raised that much more money or something. And these very same individuals that experienced this boost basically said, oh, yeah, I know work seems to come easy now and I'm doing a lot better, but it had nothing to do with that. Like, they couldn't connect it back to the fact that they had this ignited sense of purpose. They thought it was something else, So our skepticism runs pretty deep on this, but
yeah, and they're hard.
We're slowly getting it. There's, at least in the U.S., a big reason that people have quit their jobs during, what's called the Great Resignation. Actually, no, this is global data, Edelman's data. The number one reason, according to Edelman, is lack of purpose now. So we're catching on, but we still have kind of a ways to go to understand how impactful doing good for others is.
And do you think this is changing for a newer generation? I know I've certainly seen, and I don't know how scientific any of this is, but survey-based research, at least, into the views of whether we want to, well, it's not even millennials really anymore. It's Gen Z. It's probably my children who are in their teens and thereabouts, for whom, when it comes not just to their employment, but also their consumer behavior, so their patterns of purchasing, that they're starting to look for things that are meaningful, things that are making a difference, that they're attaching that meaning to their actions rather than just consuming for the sake of consuming, which is perhaps what you and I grew up with.
Yes, I think that their awareness of the options and how solid they are is much higher. So all humans yearn for purpose, and all humans prefer to have a meaningful life than not. But I think what's different, and I do think the millennials are bringing this to the workplaces. So I think what's different is that the older generations feel like, well, there's only like three things you can do about it. You can, again, become a preacher or surgeon, or you can just spend a lot of time at your church and make your life meaningful that way, or you can like try to find meaning through parenting, for example. Like, there's just very, like, these are the paths. And I mean, one thing I loved about millennials is that, like, they don't see lines. They don't see, they don't see places where it's like, stop. And I know this from talking to senior executives, where one of the things that several of them have told me is, I know that purpose is really important now in my workplace. And I'm like, well, I'm impressed. You must have measured it. You must have put it in your employee survey. And they're like, oh, no, we haven't done that. But when I walk down the hallway, millennials just come up to me and tell me, they have no boundaries of like, I shouldn't be talking to someone seven levels above me, right? They just come right up to me and tell me this is outrageous that, we're not we're not focused on doing something good for society. So I do think that seeing the world as all interconnected and everything is possible is a very good mindset. And I think it's more commonplace in the younger generations.
Yeah, which is fascinating. I mean, this is a whole other separate conversation, I think, but it's fascinating that there's that sense of perhaps empowerment and where that's come from over the course perhaps of only maybe one generation. Like, what has changed in our society for all the things that we see as dysfunction perhaps right now? What has changed in our society that we have a generation of people coming through who don't see lines, they don't see boundaries, and that may have a good thing, you know, with my psychologist hat on, that may not always be a good thing. But, you know, for the most part, they're feeling empowered to make a difference at an individual personal level and to not just have these couple of options that perhaps we saw previously. It's a fascinating idea. I'm sure a great opportunity for a lot of researchers out there to get stuck into some of that in kind of sociology, I suppose it might be. But I'm curious to know, because I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about the practical how-tos of some of this stuff for our listeners shortly, but I'm really curious to know, where did this journey start for you? How did you get involved in this field?
So about 20 years ago, I started helping companies with what is referred to as corporate social responsibility, or now environment social governance, but this idea that a company can do well by doing good. And something kept happening in the first few years, which is I would be talking to my friends that worked, that had other jobs, right? You know, they were lawyers, or, you know, they were graphic designers. And they would tell me, you know, people are so petty in my workplace. And it's like they just show up for the work. No one has any engagement. You know, they don't put in any additional effort into anything unless it's minimally required. And they're just looking out for themselves. And I was like, wow, I never have those experiences. I mean, occasionally there'll be some team member that I work with that, you know, is acting a little selfishly or something. But it wasn't a pattern in my life. And after a while, I started wondering if it had something to do with the people I was working with. And I started suspecting that it did. And then I realized the people I work with love their jobs. So these are the 8 people at FedEx that get to decide all the good that FedEx does, because their job is corporate social responsibility. So their jobs are inherently job purpose. They're trying to figure out how to lower the carbon footprint, how to get the FedEx trucks, planes to Haiti first so that, you know, they can save people's lives after an earthquake. These teams love their jobs. And I thought, why can't everybody like their job as much as they love their job? So I started looking into the idea of, really, originally it was, can we empower anybody at any level at FedEx to do their own right-sized version of corporate social responsibility? So if you can't send a plane to Haiti to help earthquake victims, you know, maybe there's something that you can do from your truck. And this ended up being the concept of job purposing. But what I discovered was that there's a woman in Florida at FedEx who, from her, you know, she delivers to residences. That's her job. She drives a truck around and she delivers packages. And she signed up to be what is called a Python patroller. So it turns out in Florida, we have these Burmese pythons that people buy as pets, and then they get too big. And then they're like, okay, we're just going to release them into the Everglades. And it's an environmental calamity because the birds have never seen these huge snakes. The rodents haven't. So they're just eating everything up, and they're now mating in the wild. So anyway, that's the background on the environmental situation. Dawn, this worker at FedEx, what she has signed up to do is to be a Python patroller. So as she's driving her FedEx truck around, she is looking for Burmese pythons. And if she finds one, then she stops, you know, they know exactly where they are. and, you know, they call the authorities and they take the python out. So when I talked to her as part of my job, you know, helping FedEx with their purpose, she basically said, you know, I've always liked my job. You know, FedEx treats me really well and, you know, good benefits and all of that. But ever since I became a python patroller, I feel like I'm slaying dragons, like my job has meaning. And so what I realized was people are doing this everywhere. You know, there's over 100 examples in my book. And the pleasure I had in finding these and just, you know, recording them and then sharing them is what led me to believe, well, this is possible for anybody. If a FedEx truck driver in Florida can find a way to make her job meaningful, it's like probably everybody can. And, you know, there's a parking attendant in Washington, D.C., and there's an administrative assistant in Geneva that has, you know, their way of job purposing. So what I realized was I can help everybody have as positive, as life-fulfilling a job as my corporate social responsibility colleagues have. And then, you know, it turns out that there's just a ton of research backing this up. And I've been involved with a bunch of the research too, to kind of make sure that, you know, we're putting a tactic out there that is effective. So I, not that I stopped doing my corporate social responsibility work or my ESG advisory work, because I do have to pay the bills, but I'm really excited about equipping anybody and any job to be able to reshape their job so that they sit down on Friday really proud. Mm. And so it took me 10 years, really, to kind of... Yeah.
It's always those stories that sound like, oh, I just made this decision, did this, did that, and it all, but there's always a much longer history and journey behind those overnight successes, if we want to call it that. So, Beat, there is a book, which I'm assuming is part of what's meaningful and purposeful to you. And as you describe that, it sounds, you know, to me, a lot of this is around education. So it's around educating individuals about the purpose that they can gain and the simple strategies for doing that and why it's important as education, perhaps for organizations, workplaces, leaders, to get past perhaps a bit of that cynicism and allow that to happen. Because as you were talking then, I'm sort of trying to put myself in the minds of maybe some of our listeners who are going, yeah, that's all very well, but my boss had never let me just stop at the side of the road to alert authorities to the fact that there's a python there that we need to, you know, I've got a schedule, I've got a meet, I've got KPIs, I've got a meet. They're not going to allow any of that to happen. How important is, and I've segued off my own question here, but I'll come back to the one about the book. How important is that understanding, or in my mind, it's a cultural element and usually driven by leadership to be able to say, okay, yeah, this is allowable? Or are people really pushing against that in order to make this happen at their own individual level?
You know, one thing I love about the concept of job purposing is that you can dial up how courageous or dial down how cautious you want to be. So, you know, the administrative assistant in Geneva, I mean, she probably overstepped her authority because she just started telling the janitors, like, you're not going to throw away that toilet paper, even though that, because they would replace it at the roll half full. She's like, you're going to leave it at my cubicle and I'm going to, you know, she started like giving orders, right? And I met her at a conference and it makes total sense because that's her personality. You know, she's the one who immediately had a question, you know, as soon as the Q&A started. And it was a difficult question. Luckily, it was for one of my panelists. And not me. So her personality is like that, you know, she likes that. But it's also true that, like in the book, there's the example of one healthcare worker, and she basically said, my way of job purposing is that every interaction I have during the day, my only goal is to have them leave that interaction just feeling better about themselves than when they came in. So, you know, she goes, I prepare a little bit. So sometimes I have in my notes to thank them for something they did a month earlier, that it was really helpful. Sometimes I just compliment them on how well they presented something in the meeting, or that, frankly, someone who's, she said, like, there's one individual who's typically 5 minutes late to all my meetings. And when he's not late, I just compliment them on that. And she says, I just feel like I'm bringing a little bit of light and a little bit of relief and joy to people, just sprinkling in a little bit. And, you know, you don't have to ask your supervisor to do that.
Mm.
And what's really amazing about that is that this research, when she told me this, did not exist. But it turns out that, like, now there's research showing that 50 seconds of an empathic conversation is so helpful to the recipient that they have linked it to recovering from a cold one day earlier. And to a boosted immune system response. So literally, I don't know, some cells, I don't know if they were T cells or something, they measured, were higher for those who received the 50 seconds of an empathic conversation. So she's right. She is making a meaningful contribution to others out there by just doing that. And by the way, when she got a hold of the book, she was about to quit her job. Mm-hmm. She's more in the admin end of healthcare. And she just said that it was remote. And, you know, this was like during lockdown, and she just felt really isolated and everything. And I mean, she said, I'm holding on because now my days, they go by quicker. They feel better. She goes, I would still rather not work at all. So to be fair, it's not. But she goes, my job is on the positive end of the spectrum now, where before it was on the negative end of the spectrum. And it's been at least a year and a half, and she's still at that job. So I think that if you don't have the authority, or you don't even want to ask for permission, then find something that fits within the scope of your ability to make decisions. So
I love that notion of being able to dial up, because as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, for an individual who has a strength of courage, for example, you know, when we talk about, and I know I've talked about this on the show before, so listeners will hopefully remember, you know, you cite a tool like the VIA Strengths, which is assessing personality or character strengths. And we know that these, when we are able to use them, help us to feel energized and empowered. And they're kind of core and essential to who we are. So being able to link something like courage, if that's a strength, and to use it, but then to also know, you know, if that's not your strength, that's okay. Then it's finding, you know, what is my strength? And for some of those people, so that interesting thing about, you know, just trying to make other people's lives a little happier, sprinkle that little bit of joy, you know, the strength that came to mind then was just that strength of love and kindness, you know, so that is your strength. And, you know, we've got these beautiful bilateral experience here that the recipient is obviously receiving positive emotion in the moment, but there's, from the sounds of things, from the sounds of that research, a whole lot of other more kind of core, almost perhaps to metabolic level stuff that's going on there that, you know, we don't understand, but we know is an effect, as well as the giver of that, you know, the sprinkler of the joy is obviously getting that meaning and sense of meaning, right? And the energy and all the positive effects that you talked about earlier at a physiological and psychological level as well. So we kind of can't lose, in a way, from what you're saying with these simple, and I think that's the key thing, you know, in your book, it's how simple acts of social purpose drive success and well-being. It's magic. Is it magic?
It is amazingly powerful.
And on that very upbeat note, we're going to leave this conversation with Bea, but the great news is that we will continue it in our next episode. This entire conversation with Bea was so good and so long that we have split it into two parts. So please tune in again next week to hear Bea and I talk about her ideas of people taking simple action to job purpose in some really cool ways. There's some great ideas in there. Why the ripple effect of individuals doing good through work is a little bit like falling in love. And why doing good builds a culture of doing good and how those simple actions can make work a great place to be pretty simply and pretty easily. And while you're waiting for that episode to drop, check out the show notes for today's conversation. We've included all of the references and studies and books that Bea mentioned, as well, of course, as a link to her book, Do Good at Work, How Simple Acts of Purpose Drive Success and Wellbeing. There's also a transcript of today's conversation and a link to Bea's website. It's all at potential.com.au/podcast, where you will also find all of our past episodes, all 123 of them. And if you want to get social, we're on Instagram and LinkedIn and Facebook, and you can watch the video of each episode of the Potential Psychology Podcast on YouTube. Just search Potential Psychology. And if you're interested in seeing Bea speak live and attending a workshop on job purposing with her, she will be doing both of those things in Ballarat, Victoria on the 23rd of March 2023. She's the keynote speaker for the Committee for Ballarat's Corporate Citizenship Conference, which is a big little event that the team at Committee and I are bringing to life. To find out more, go to committeeforballarat.com. That's all one word, and committee has two M's and two T's and two E's. It's a hard one. committeeforballarat.com, or just message me and I'll send you the details. Big thanks to my team, Jay and Sherry and Andy, for their work on this week's episode to bring it to your ears. While we're all waiting for part two of my conversation with Bea, please go forth and fulfil your potential.